This edition of the Swim Brief is brought to you by Pro Swim Workouts. One of the most frequent requests I hear from other coaches is they're looking for workout inspiration. Head coaches, you can sign up for a membership right now and get your whole coaching staff involved and start sharing that inspiration right away. Right now, enter the coupon code CRDESANTIS in all caps. You get 20% off when purchasing a premium subscription. And the best part is you'll support Chris DeSantis Coaching with your purchase. The Swim Brief is also brought to you by Chris DeSantis Coaching. Do you want to be a college swim coach but are frustrated by sending your applications into the void? That is the NCAA job board. Go to chrisdcoach.com. That's C-H-R-I-S, D as in downtown, coach.com, and write me via the contact form. There's a process to getting into the college system, and college swimming needs more good coaches. If you're a club coach who wants to make a change, or somebody just getting started out, I can help. This week on the Swim Brief, I'm joined by Nico Messer from Pro Swim Workouts, once again all the way from Switzerland. It's also the first, but probably not the last, three-person Swim Brief, as we welcome Paul Yetter. Paul has been on numerous international coaching staffs for the United States, most notably as a coach on the 2008 Olympic team. He was also the 2007 USA Swimming Developmental Coach of the Year and is currently the head senior coach at North Baltimore Aquatic Club. We get into a really good discussion of test sets, measuring stuff in practice, and the many forms that takes. Enjoy. Hello, Nico, and hello, Paul.
Hey, Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Great to have you guys both on the podcast, the first three-person podcast we're doing here. And Nico and I are super excited to have Paul Yetter on the podcast today. Paul and I think we met at Olympic Trials in 2008, and that was at the time that he was coaching Katie Hoff, and he was first at North Baltimore Aquatic Club, and now he's back at North Baltimore Aquatic Club. Paul, tell us a little bit about where your professional swimming coaching career has taken you over the last few years.
Well, from that time in 2008, I spent 1 year at Auburn, and then I spent 6 years at T2 Aquatics in Naples, Florida. And I've been back in Baltimore since November 15th of 2016.
And what's your role now at North Baltimore? What are you doing there?
My title is the head senior coach. I coach two groups of athletes, and then, you know, I try to chip in and just help out with the entire team as much as I can.
And what's it been like going back to Baltimore? What drew you back there, and had you returning to the club where you first really made a big name for yourself?
Well, what drew me back there was the job opportunity. It became an open job opportunity. But you know, it's very rarely in life do you get to sort of go back to one of your first jobs. And, you know, I started coaching at NBAC in 2001. I was 25. So now I'm 41. You know, I spent 9 years coaching at NBAC, and then I, you know, went away for 7 years. So I've learned a lot, and learned a lot about myself and a lot about what I'm doing. And now I have the opportunity, I think, is the unique opportunity to come back into the job that I once had, you know, to kind of do it and try to enhance the things that I was doing with the same job 7 or 8 years ago.
And give me a little insight, like, what's the biggest thing maybe that's different, that's changed for what you need to be successful in a club like North Baltimore? from 2010 until now, or is it mostly the same?
Well, I mean, what we need to be successful now versus what we need to be successful that what we had to have within us to be successful then.
Yeah.
I think it's, for me, there's kind of a sense of, well, I want to try to do some of the things that we used to do back then and just basically try to, rebuild the same machine, so to speak. But at the same time, the human organism isn't a machine, so everybody's different. So I've got to figure out ways to sort of manipulate that, and try to do well by each individual person within, the kind of framework that I felt, guided us to the success that we had in the time that I was at MBAC prior to this stint here.
Yeah, and it's been a place that's been incredibly successful over the years, and produced a lot of world-class swimmers coming out of that area. Why do you think that is?
I think there's an expectation for success at MBAC that it's not totally unique. I mean, I think there's a lot of, there are certainly other clubs in the United States where, there's an expectation for not only national success, but potentially international success. There's an expectation that athletes in their teens can race athletes in their 20s and 30s. There's an expectation that, on a daily basis, the work is going to get done and it's going to get done at a high level and there's going to be some focus. So, but, at MBAC, there's just sort of this, it's like an unwritten thing with the athletes where, you're sort of on the out crowd if you're not a hard worker, everybody works differently. There's just to be black and white about it, there's sprinters and distance swimmers, right? But everybody works hard on their craft in different ways. And whichever way that's going to be for each individual athlete, they have to work hard and expect, results on a daily basis. I mean, practice results and maybe technical proficiency results, improving your technique or maybe, getting better in, sort of a mental way on a given day, but some sort of like a result, the athlete's going to get on a daily basis. So when they get to the meet, they've sort of done that a lot of times already. So that's something I think sets MBAC apart, where if you think like that, that's sort of normal. And if you don't think like that, you either start to think like that pretty quickly, or you're not really, in the in crowd.
Mm. And I think that's a great segue into what we're going to talk about today, because we're going to talk about test sets. And I think talk about swimmers putting some pressure on themselves for results in practice and wanting to have some sort of cumulative like measure before they get to a competition that indicates to them, hey, I'm going to be successful, or I've done the work, or I'm working hard. Is that the other thing? And this subject of test sets definitely has a lot of intersection with that. But maybe we're going to get into a lot of different definitions of what exactly is a test set, and how it fits what you're talking about. But before we get there, Nico, we've got a little poll related to last week's episode. Do you want to tell people what that is?
Sure. We do. And so we talked about the 100-100s. I just put up a little poll to find out what people like think about it, if they did it, if they haven't done it yet, if they may consider doing it after listening to the show. Just to gather some like unofficial data on that kind of particular set. Right now it's been three people and I'm one of the three, so I wouldn't say it's like a good crowd to like say, oh, people like it or people don't like it. So if you could go there and just take part in the poll, so we have a little bit bigger data set to work with, and we may, whenever we come back to sets like this, maybe can relate off of this a little bit. That would maybe help and be fun to know.
Yeah, I got to get on there and tell everybody how much I dislike 100-100. so go to proswimworkouts.com and give your opinion and let us know, because we want to know more about what people are thinking out there and what they're using and what is useful to them. Do you like 100-100s, Paul?
Well, I haven't used it, but yeah. You know, I could tell you, like David Heron, who swims for Tennessee, did 100, and I think he did 100 on 110 on a long course. I know that his training group attempted that, and I know there were a few guys that did it. In fact, they won 101. I think that's right. Maybe they did more, but I can't say for sure that David did that exactly. But I know that his training group did that, and he's the national champion in the 5K this year. So, you know, there's a spot for that for you know, different groups of people and different events. You know, and USA Swimming is expanding their, well, in the world of swimming now with the medley relays and just the extra events. I mean, now, you know, people are going from a, you know, from a 50 breaststroke to a 10K, so, or 25K if you think about world championships. So there's a lot of different types of swimming. You know, it's almost like there's three different sports. There's 25K, there's, you know, 5 and 10K, and then there's the pool swimming.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it's even close.
I mean, when we think about how much longer that race is and how much more diversification there is for sports like track and field with athletes, you know, like races of those kind of relative length, I think you're making a great point. So let's talk about test sets. Let's talk a little bit on the front end, just like, what is a test set? What kind of definition do we have for test sets? Because this is actually something I've always struggled with, because I think I've talked to people, other coaches who seem into test sets, and I get really into the part of, yes, like, let's have some measurable stuff in practice, some tangible stuff that swimmers can see they're getting better. But then I feel like a lot of what people consider test sets don't seem really that applicable to race situations. But I'm curious to what kind of insight you guys have. I mean, Nico, like, how do you define a test set?
Well, I was really like wondering about that leading into this show, because I was kind of trying to figure out what did I do maybe as an athlete like a long time ago or now as a coach that I would maybe qualify as a test set. And like the first thing that came to mind that I did as an athlete, and I just recently done with some of the national team athletes over here in Switzerland, is like the step test. Right, so it's like with lactate testing. So it's not just time. There's more value to the whole testing with the blood testing and stuff like that that goes into it, which we used to do 5 200s now. Just recently with the national team, we did 8 200s. I don't know, like people are doing for like step tests, they do 8 100s or 6 400s. I've seen stuff like that. But then I'm also in coaching with my last coaching job in Zurich. I've been coaching a little group of little kids, and I hated their kicking, like their attitude to kicking. And I thought they should be able to go 8 50s on a minute and just kind of not cruise, but like have a solid kick, make the water boil, and just make 8 on a minute. And we did this every week till they made it. And it almost took the full season. And maybe the first couple workouts, two of them did it, then a fourth and six, and at the end, everyone did it. I was kind of like, well, was that a test set? Because we did it over and over and again, and it was a test for them, even though like I didn't write down their times or how happy I was with their effort or any kind of data that I used. I just used those 850s for those kids.
Yeah, I think that you bring up a good point, because I wasn't even thinking about the test sets in terms of lactic acid testing. And I think definitely the influence, and what we'll give out a link to him later, of Jan Ulbricht in European Swimming has made those lactate testing test sets very popular. Also, Bill Sweetenham And I have to make a confession that when I took over my head coaching job in Denmark, the previous coach handed over to me in a cardboard box his lactic acid testing kit, and I never once opened it, because I really, first off, I didn't do any kind of sets that where I would test something like that, and I wouldn't have any idea what to do with it. And I was also a little bit in the American mindset, like, I'm going to be pricking swimmers in the finger on the pool deck. Is this legal? Is somebody going to get mad at me? Paul, what about you? What do you include in your definition of testing?
Well, I think it's anything that's measured. You know, I mean, if you want to go off of a definition, I'm not sure of the origin of test sets and training, you know, whether it comes from track and field or swimming or what. Like, I'm pretty sure about the origin of Fartlek training, for instance, but, you know, the idea of testing, I'm not sure where that first came from, but I would imagine that it came from coaches' first inclination to measure and record for the basis of then using later to transcend the variables that were measured and recorded. And so, I mean, people have been doing test sets forever. I mean, I guess, like, you know, great coaches are going to make everything a test set, because with a test set, you've got, you know, your basic scientific method, you know, and I think you should have your basic scientific method for every practice and every set. Of course, it's pretty hard to do, you know, but, you know, if you could really do it well, you'd have, you know, you have your procedure, which is your practice, but you'd have your hypothesis, you know, you'd have your conclusion, you'd have your results, and then you kind of go on to the next experiment. So, you know, I mean, I understand what most people kind of term as test sets, you know, where one or two times a week you're doing something that's going to be measured and then repeated a certain amount of time later. But I think that, you know, that's why I want to know where the origin comes from. Because, like, when you're coaching athletes, you know, in the United States, and you've got, you know, I've got four lanes of six kids in one of my training groups, and I've got, you know, four or five lanes if we use a fifth lane of, you know, four kids in a lane in my other training group. And it's just really tough to, you know, take just to do, you know, to do test sets with a larger group. So I think, you know, it's possible that test sets started to happen in smaller groups of athletes, or could be easily recorded and easily measured. So I guess that gets us started. I just really, you know, right off the bat, don't use a lot of test sets. There's, you know, the 10-300s on 330 or on another interval, and sometimes we do a little bit less. I use that, and I put it in John Urbanchik's color chart. But, you know, if I had to argue one side or the other, it's probably easier for me to argue against the traditional use of test sets, and it's probably easier to argue for just kind of making every day sort of a experiment.
Yeah, I think you bring up some really good points in there. One of them is measurement, right? In that, you know, if you're a coach and you're describing a situation where I think I understand you, like, you're coaching and you've got 24 athletes in the water, four lanes of six kids each. And, you know, if you set them off on something that you're going to use and extrapolate for measuring their progress, you want to be pretty precise about the way in which you're measuring how they're doing. And that's a challenge for any coach, to really get precise measurements on what the athletes are doing. I mean, yes, you could sit there with a stopwatch and be timing all 24 swimmers, but then your attention comes away from actually watching them swim. You know, maybe you have an assistant coach to do that, but then the assistant coach is giving all their attention to that sort of one task. You could have the swimmers measure mm-hmm. it themselves. So there's a lot of considerations there. And I think also you speak to that broader definition of of what a test set is or what a practice where things are measured is. Nico,
sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, even though it's kind of impossible to measure it exactly right, it's like, well, was a kid leading the lane or were they going five back? I mean, that makes it a lot different, right?
Right.
Or are we doing it in groups? We're doing it from a dive, that kind of thing. But I would say that the biggest thing for me is more along the lines of the athletes that I've tended to work with for most of my career have been teenagers. And, a lot of the testing to me, I think, takes us out of training. I think, you could make the argument that when you're testing, you're not training. And I think, these athletes are so dynamic, the teenage athletes, and I think they're getting faster every day. And to me, just from my experience watching them, kind of a lot of test sets end up being high lactate test sets or just like harder than it needs to be for that particular day or that particular time of the season. I think we sort of need to keep track of what it is that we're actually trying to accomplish with the athletes. And, 15-year-old, 14-year-old kids don't do as well with high lactate training. And so the testing becomes sort of like the 8-100s on 6 minutes type of thing, then I don't think they progress as well as if you're doing, a little bit more of a descending and active rest type of training plan. So, it's not that we just sort of like can't measure it, because I think we can. I mean, we've done some pretty creative things, like basically, putting a handheld recorder on when I'm announcing times so I can remember all the times and all the names, to go with it. Just little things like that,
yeah.
To kind of like help keep track. But, I guess the big thing is we just measure everything. there's nothing that we really don't measure. I measure things less now than I used to, but, we measure everything. We know that, for instance, if we're doing an IM, let's say we're doing a 300 IM and we end with a 75 from the breaststroke, to the freestyle, and we time that 75 short course, for instance, let's say we time it and it's a 40, then what I do is I do a mathematical equation and I multiply that 75 by 3 and I get 2 minutes. And then that's basically a short course to long course conversion. 375s is 200 meters. So we measure that. We say, okay, if you're doing a 40, then it's not 2 minutes, but it's a 30. And that's like coming home in 30. Mm. So we measure everything. I think it's a better, it's almost more of a conversation for me, like, what don't we measure? Because we just measure everything if we're doing a good job. Obviously there's days when we don't measure everything, but certainly the main stuff, I mean, we're measuring their splits. We're measuring their within training that has two different types of disciplines, or let's say a kick and a swim involved in, like, let's say go 50 kick, 50 swim hundreds. We're measuring the 50s and talking to the athlete, hey, you're going out in 35, coming back in 30, improve one of those variables and you're going under 105. Those types of things.
Yeah, see, this is why I know, at least personally, I was so excited to have you on, Paul. You're a coach's coach. You've got a lot of you're thinking a lot about what you're doing, and I think it's really useful for the people that are listening to this just to hear sort of that thought process. Nico, what about this point that Paul's making? Like, and I think it's a good one when you talk about the intensity of some of these test sets. I mean, like. If you read Ulbricht's book, which I know again is a hugely influential piece of swim coaching literature. I mean, if you're doing something that really gets lactic acid levels way up, such that you would be measuring it. I mean, doesn't this create a huge recovery window on the other end that sort of holds you back from training after that?
It probably does. You know, what we did with the national team recently with that A200. It's starting out pretty easy, but it takes a lot of time because you take a break after three, because you have to try to regulate the lactate values and just kind of give them enough rest so they don't lose it as too much, but keep on a level where they can keep improving their performance throughout the set. And then at the end, you still need a lot of time to see how it drops back down. So what ends up happening in this setting is for A200s, you end up spending 3 to 4 hours at the pool. And it takes a lot of manpower, you know. It's it's getting easier to use all this stuff, you know. I mean, you got a kit for lactate testing from the coach that on the team that was there before you. It's not like a really difficult science or something that's difficult to do, but it takes a lot of time, and I believe it takes a lot of commitment, because if you do it once, you've never done it.
Right.
I think that was a good point that Paul also made. It's kind of like, you know, some kids could be really good in performing at practice. Some may not be as good in performance at practice yet. What I always noted by doing test sets, which one of the sets I actually like to do and I did on a regular basis, was 15-100s, kind of like a best average kind of type of thing going into it. But what I notice is they get better at the sets the more you do them. So I don't know how many you would have to do to actually make it meaningful. And that's a big thing why I don't use a lot of test sets, because I'm not a big fan of doing things over and over again, because I think it's boring, and if I think it's boring, probably the athletes think the same too, you know. And another thing is, you know, it's the measurement. If you do stuff like that, you need to measure it, being it by using a stopwatch, time, doing heart rates, or something like a exertion scale where they tell you how hard it was or something like that. You need to write it down. You need to file it somewhere. And I never was that guy who like was at practice and was like digging my head into a paper and writing stuff down. I much rather look at the athlete swim and try to be as calm as I can. So it's just, I think it's also kind of like a coaching style that you have to maybe have to really make the best use of them.
Yeah, I think, and this sort of leads me to another point that I want to ask Paul about, because he's been at the top of, you know, a lot of big club swimming structures, and you know, there's definitely an age appropriateness discussion to be had about this. You know, in terms of, first off, what kind of measurements, if any, can you use at different ages, different ability levels? And then, I mean, how much, like, you know, for a 10-year-old swimmer, for instance, like how much can they use, you know, in terms of measurable stuff at practice? I mean, what opinions do you have on that, Paul?
Well, like for 10-year-olds, I know that my brother Tom at T2, and also when he was at MBAC, he would do like 500 kick for time, 1,000 kick for time, things like that. It's fun stuff for kids, put the stuff up on the wall, and the kids will get a lot faster. You know, so I think, you know, in terms of age appropriate, one of the reasons that kicking is something that he chose is because there's no bad stroke technique. I mean, you could argue that there is, you know, if you're kicking with a board, you know, you're certainly not in the same body position you'd like to be in sprint freestyle. But I think there's some benefits that you get from that as well that might balance that out. But just generally speaking, you're not going to get a 9-year-old kid to just crank out 15 minutes of just rushed swimming. which, you know, it just doesn't really benefit anybody to have to do that at that age, or really at any age. So, you know, I'd say, like, as they get a little bit older, you know, you could do just, I mean, some of the things that we've always done at MBAC is just, you know, 15 100s kick, where you go 5-5, you know, and drop the interval by 5 seconds. Let's say 5 on 130, 5 on 125, and rest 30 or rest a minute, and then do 5 on 120, you know, 5 seconds faster. So we do that. But, you know, at the older age groups, I do 10 300s with athletes who are going to swim, you know, under 3:10s, short course yards. I'll do it on 3:30, you know, so the idea is 30 seconds rest, but, you know, if they're going to go between 2:50 and 3:10, that's good. If they're just not quite ready to go, you know, at least under, well, let's say if they're in our top training group and they can at least, you know, swim under 3:20, then, you know, I just basically try to keep everybody on the same interval. But, you know, if I've got other people that need a bigger interval, if I've got younger athletes, then I'll give them a bigger interval so that they get 30 rest. But, you know, that test set and what you get from it, I think it affects my viewpoint on mid-distance athletes, distance athletes, and some sprinters. Mm. But some sprinters, it just doesn't work as well as maybe some other things. So we've come up with kind of like a strategy to use with people who specialize in, let's say, the 100 and the 50 and come up to the 200, because, you know, as much as with, in particular with club swimming, I feel that you have to have the mid-distance program be sort of like the base program, and you can go, you know, in both directions from there. I don't know exactly where I was going with that, but I think that's, you know, that's something that a club program has to have, is sort of like the attitude of the mid-distance stuff is what we're going to do. I think it's really hard to build a team of 200 plus around, you know, 50 freestyle as of the event that you choose to train for. But let's face it, there are some really talented athletes in our training groups. And, you know, if you have somebody who's a thoroughbred sprinter and they've got to do things where they have to, for instance, you know, breathe every stroke, let's just say, is a good example. But the 50 freestyle is their big event at Olympic trials. You know, that's, we've got to watch out for that, you know, make sure that the amount that we're doing and the rest intervals that we have helps that athlete as much as possible while still trying to get, you know, that certain type of work done. But, I guess I'm just trying to figure out where exactly I was going with that.
Well, yeah, I think you were talking about some of the kinds of adjustments and testing you would make for sprint swimmers.
So what we do is we take the 200 time, and this is something that I got from Bob Trofine, who's an exercise scientist who ended up helping Australian swimming for years. I believe it was in the late 80s and through the 90s, and who knows, probably now. I don't really know. It's kind of hard to find literature and talks on this, but it is out there. But he'll do like a take your 200 best time, divide it, and add 4 for what he calls critical speed pace. Now that's faster than what I would call red pace or threshold pace. But if you take your 200 and divide it and add 7 seconds, that tends to give you an idea about where kind of a 100 meter threshold pace might be. So I kind of use that. And then I made a chart that basically has, you know, on the left side of the chart, your 200 best time. And then on the right side of the chart, it has what your critical speed pace is. And then I have 100, 150, a 200, and a 300. And I just paces that I've basically come up with just through intuition of where they should be. And I used that a lot when I was with T2 and I had a group of postgraduates that, you know, tended to swim 200 and down. And it's like doing the 10, 300s. We just didn't do that.
Yeah.
I think they probably would have run me off the deck.
Yeah.
But we did it that way, and we would design sets that were a little bit shorter, but I thought aerobically effective at the same time.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story, you know, just to sort of get on the other end of spectrum with these test sets. For the last year that I was in Denmark, I got employed by a club there, and my job was to just coach darts. So I showed up to the pool 2 times a week, 2 hours. I actually sat in a chair for the first time in my coaching career, which felt very lazy, but was the best vantage point for me to film the starts from. And I just filmed starts and one or two swimmers at a time in little 20-minute blocks. And, you know, part of them hiring me to do that was, hey, we would like to know whether we're getting anything out of it. So they would measure probably once every few weeks. They would measure 15-meter time for the swimmer to see if there was some sort of reasonable impact being made on the 15-meter. And that was something that they kept pretty detailed records of. And it wasn't like, you know, they would expect that there was improvement in 15-meter times every 2 to 3 weeks, because there were a lot more factors than just how good their start was that went into how they were doing on that sort of thing. But they definitely wanted to be able to measure something. And that was very useful for me, because now when I propose to people that they should let me come in and help them with starts, I can say, well, here's the kind of improvement you should expect by getting me involved. So that's been an area which you measure something sort of very short and very small and very very strict part of it. I want to talk a little bit more with Nico and just make sure that, because I think that a lot of the lactate testing protocols that you're talking about are perhaps a little bit more popular in Europe. And Europe has some good swimmers, right? So give us the idiot's version of lactate testing, why you do it, and what kind of things you're looking for when you do a lactate testing set.
Well, you know, as you said, I guess it really over here in Europe comes from the big influence that Dr. Jan Albrecht had on his theories and like his book, The Science of Winning, which is kind of based on this. And he's known for this over here. The Dutch team, I think they still work with him. I think the British work with him too. And those guys used to have a lot of success in the past and still are having a lot of success applying what he thinks is the right way to train. And this lactate testing is a big part of it. So, but basically, you know, it's the same principle that like Paul was talking about. It at the end of the day, it's going to help you figure out training paces. So if you want to go and swim at 80% or 60% of your max effort, you know your heart rate should be at 20 beats in 10 seconds. Your lactate should be in this zone. Your time should be this fast. And if you keep doing the testing, maybe you can say your training improved your threshold, and now everything moved a little bit to the right. So you're going to be maybe on the threshold part of the chart that you get from that lactate testing. You're going to be maybe a little bit faster because now you're better conditioned, you're more mature, you're 1 year older. You can do a little bit better on this part, but maybe your top end speed hasn't changed because you're someone who really builds up a lot of lactic acid, and you're just not going to hold it together there. I don't think that a lot of teams, on the other hand, over here in Europe, really do it the way they're supposed to do it. And by that I mean, you know, they do it once because maybe you heard it's cool to do. The kits are not cheap per se, but it's not a really expensive thing to get. And you may just, like, your coach gave you the kit, have someone tell you, well, you should do lactate testing because it's really going to make your athletes better. So that's probably why a lot of people end up doing it, and they do it once, and they think they can write off that data for the whole season or multiple seasons, which is probably wrong, you know, because it, what I saw from the national team athletes, things change because you can have a bad day and everything can be completely off. And not saying that the test that day, you could just stay at home and sleep. The test probably is still going to show something, maybe helping you with your recovery. You know, a lot of what the national team in Switzerland used it for at the end of the day, the lactate testing, was for recovery protocols at meets. So they knew that if they come out of the pool after race, they have a lactate 10, they need to go and swim down for that many minutes in order to clear and be ready for another race the same day, in the afternoon, or maybe the next day. So not sure that all of what is done with the lactate testing over here really is what we would call test sets, because it's not maybe applied just for training, but also like for recovery and other stuff.
Inside, and you know, she just could go so fast in practice for so long. It's like, you know, she was just really coaching her was like just a it was my ability to mix up the neural imprint on what was happening with her each day that was allowing her to kind of like keep going fast. And so just learning how to coach, well, I learned really by watching my coach, Murray Stevens. And then I learned from watching Bob. And then, you know, when you're watching Bob with Bob Bowman with Michael, it's like, you know, Michael's doing the type of training that is preparing him to become not only a gold medalist, but the best all around swimmer in the history of the world with all strokes, all distances. And so every day was something different. And, you know, Bob was doing that, basically doing that same thing. You know, he's going to do a full day of backstroke. And there's going to be, you know, he's not going to work on the breaststroke. And then he's going to come back to breaststroke the next day or later in the week. So, you know, that's my, you know, introduction to coaching. And then I get Katie in my training pool. It's like, okay. She's just, you know, this active rest stuff that we're doing, you know, kind of like you're going at 200 fast, 100 easy, and then 150 fast, 100 easy, 75 fast, 75 easy. And this stuff is fun. And she's just flying around the pool, you know. And yeah. We did, you know, that first year when she was younger, we did, you know, 10,000 yard workouts, and we did some pretty good aerobic work. But I hadn't had enough experience as a coach to prescribe proper aerobic work. I think, you know, and this is something that our coaches here at MBAC have been talking about. I think that it's probably a huge challenge for coaches to come up with a really good kind of have the athletes kind of like right on their threshold, right where their oxygen is still their fuel, and just be able to hold that for, you know, a certain amount of time that fits well into your week. So, you know, I think it's a really skillful thing. I don't think it's a very easy thing to do. I think that, you know, mistakes are made, like the sets are too long, the intervals are too hard, the intervals are too easy. You know, there's all these different mistakes that you can make with it. And certainly my first few years with Katie, I didn't really know what it's doing. So I kind of learned that, you know, in 2006, Katie had a couple swims at the Pan Pac meet that were like, you know, basically the same things she did the previous year, a little bit slower with her IMs. And I talked with John Urbanchik and I talked with Coach Schubert about different things to improve on. And so I took both of their different pieces of advice. And one of them was to have Katie do a test set and to plug her time into the program that John gave me. So I did that. You know, I think her first time we did the 10-300, she probably averaged 251 or 252. I plugged it into the program. And what I saw was really amazing. And this is where the really interesting part comes in. She, you know, I looked, for instance, and I saw, okay, when I look at her red pace 200, that's prescribed after I plug in this, you know, 251.8 average, okay? And it's a 154 that spits out as her 200 red pace.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, well, she doesn't do a lot of 154s in practice right now. It's really interesting, but she does do 152s, which is the like the blue pace, which is like sort of like some of the faster paces. And she does, you know, under 150 in practice. That's like the purple pace. So she does those. She also does the white pace, the easiest pace. She does that in warm up. And she also does the pink pace, which is the second easiest pace, one below red. And she does that, you know, during presets and the beginning of the sets. But she never does the red pace. You know, she gets going and then boom, she's right to like the fastest stuff.
Yeah.
And so we started doing sets, and it was great because we had measured everything every day. And I'd been getting to the point where it's like, well, her fastest 150 breaststroke she ever did was when she was 14. It's like, she wasn't going to go that fast. Like, she got better in the IM for their breaststroke, but you know, that 135.7 she did when she was 14, she just never did it again.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I was done kind of like, there was a point, and I think Katie was done too. It's just like measuring everything. So we still measured everything, but it was more like, okay, let's go, you know, I mean, let's do something like, let's go 3-400s on 425 and hold the white pace that's prescribed, which for like 4 minutes. And then let's do some, 300s and hold the pink pace that's prescribed. It's like 258s or something. And then let's go, you know, rest a minute and go 6-200s and just hold that 154. And here's what I really kind of learned, you know, the red pace is key for gear switching. And, you know, when you're able to really train that threshold pace and really do a good job with it, try to do it with a low heart rate, you know, and try to do it for the right amount of time, which I think is like 25 to 30 minutes or maybe a little bit less than that, if you, you know, in red pace, you know, but, you know, the whole set may be 40 minutes or 30 minutes. But, I think that in a race, the ability to accelerate in the middle of the race, as everybody wants to do, but then have another gear where you can accelerate again at the end of the race, I think that's really tough. Yeah. And if you do enough fast swimming and enough active rest swimming and enough, you know, work on, okay, if you're a really fast swimmer, you're going to put your feet on the wall. Let's say if you're a fast female 100 freestyler and your head at the 15 meter mark off the wall is going to be a 7 low. You know, you've got to do all those types of things. But if you're doing all those kinds of things, and then you're doing this really nice threshold work, which I try to do 2, 3, or 4 times a week with different athletes, everybody in my mind's got a certain amount, then I think you're going to have yourself a really well-rounded athlete who can actually access that speed that they're working on when it's real, when it really counts. And I mean, I do think that 200 meters and up is what I've used it for, you know, with the most success. And I've tended to go towards some other measurements with kind of what I'm looking for in practice with sprinters and older athletes. But, you know, that you know, putting the red pace on the athletes that particular year was one of the best things we did. We also had a boy go 419 in high school in the 500, and you know, 135 in the 200. And it was, that was Dan Madwed. And he added that, you know, just like Katie did. So, you know, we saw some real success with it. And now my thing is I'm trying to get the athletes to do it, you know, as much as I really want them to do it, because they don't want to, you know, athletes don't want to do it really as much as I want. If I want four, they want three. I've got a couple that want five, but mostly they want one less.
Well, this is where I see actually the intersection of actually the three of us here on this podcast as I'm listening to you talk about this. Because I think, you know, when Nico talks about testing lactic, that all the sort of lactic acid testing that they're doing in Europe, I think the really important thing there is sort of figuring out where that line is when swimmers sort of boil over in terms of that threshold where if you just insist on training them at that, and it doesn't have to be that far past that line, day in, day out, you're just not going to end up with positive results. And swimmers may be, these are the swimmers who feel like, hey, I'm coming in, I'm working really hard, and I'm actually staying exactly where I am, or even sort of moving backwards. Some of the stuff that you described with Katie, you know, back in 2006. So figuring out, and I'm a huge proponent of race-paced swimming. I like some of the aspects of USRPT, but what I like about it is very similar to what you're describing, is the part where you're basically finding out what kind of swimming can you power through your aerobic system, and how can you make sure swimmers are training there so that they are both working hard and getting some sort of training effect, like they're working hard enough that they get an effect from the training that they're doing, but they're not doing, they're not pushing so often past it that they actually sort of stay stuck in place or move backward. And that's a very hard thing to figure out with any kind of swimmer that you have. And especially you reference like a world-class swimmer like Katie Hoff. She will have completely different borderline for where that is than some of the other swimmers you've coached, right?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I think that can be dangerous too for inexperienced coaches, like if they hear you know, a presentation like in modern times, like, you know, somebody's going to come up and everyone wants to hear like what's Ledecky doing, what is her training like, and if they think that they can go back and do the exact same sets with their swimmers and that will help them to a world-class performance, I think they're mistaken. Did you ever feel like there were people who, you know, were trying to emulate Katie but perhaps it just wasn't the kind of work she was doing, just wasn't for them?
Do you mean people that are in my, under my supervision?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for you to talk about what people were doing in other practices unless you've got some stories there. But
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I think people probably were more inspired by Katie, and they were, you know, that's, again, going back to the beginning of our conversation at MBAC. I mean, it's valued to kind of be a go-getter. So yeah. There wasn't a lot of, you know, shaming and that kind of thing that does go on sometimes with athletes and teams when somebody just steps up and just takes off. And, you know, it's like, if you're going to be a world record holder, you pretty much have to be way out in front of everybody. You know, I mean, that's one of the arguments against, you know, the people who feel like you have to have training partners. Well, if you're going to be a world record holder, you're going to transcend your training partners, and you need to transcend your training partners, or you're not going to be a world record holder. So, but yeah, I mean, there's with our jobs, we have to find what different ways to do it. And I think what I'm hearing from our conversation is there's a lot of different ways to do this. You know, I mean, you bring up the Dutch team. They've been swimming very fast for a long time. And, you know, the world of swimming is just, it's getting more and more diverse at the highest levels. So there's a lot of people that are doing it a lot of different ways. And I think it speaks to the similarities that these people have is probably non-physical. You know, the makeup of a champion, you know, varies physically, perhaps more than it does in, you know, the kind of the mental way or however you want to term it.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point there. I think that, you know, one of the smartest things I've ever heard about stroke technique is, you know, don't look for what one particular world-class swimmer, the way that they are doing. Look for the similarities in a world-class field of swimmers.
Yeah.
What do they have in common technically? And I think that, often I find when we start talking about test sets or training or what people do practice, coaches, because it's right there and it's tangible, it's right in front of our faces, it can quickly sort of turn into an argument about which is the right way, when I think that there's a lot more to be learned by let's look at the best performance and what do these swimmers have in common in the way that they're preparing to do this, rather than, oh, these two different ways are completely different. You know, it's either this way or that way that you have to do it. Nico, what we haven't heard from you here in a little bit. What do you think about the sort of commonalities between what we've been discussing here, and what's your perspective?
Well, you know, one thing that stood out for me and people listening, if you want to know what Paul does or has done in the past, I mean, he has a lot of workouts on our site, and you can get a lot from them without taking it from the website, going to your team and doing the exact same workout, but look at the workout and try to figure out what he was trying to do. And he usually did a good job explaining what he tried to do and try to apply the same goal to your group and see how it works. But something that really stood out for me is kind of like, you know, we were talking about before the measurement, like Paul was talking about how some of that measurement became intuition. And it's something that, you know, I'm like the one who has the least experience in the three of us in coaching. But I noticed there's a big part of science to coaching. There's a lot of stuff that you need to understand. But as much things that you can measure, if you work with your athletes, and at some point you're gonna know those things by feel, and it may not be the same every day for the same effort that you want for. Let's say red pace or something like that, and by intuition, the athlete's gonna know it, and you're gonna know it. And I guess a good thing to do, like no matter what training you do, is kind of like trust your gut a little bit more, because sometimes, like I notice, you have this great plan, and you just want to stick to the plan, and your gut is telling you something else, and probably sticking to the plan is not the right way to go.
Yeah, and Nico, I will say to you. You know, there's actual good science behind intuition. So, one of the biggest theories about intuition out there is that at the front end of whenever you're trying, your brain is trying to reason its way through something, because it's a new sort of reasoning that you're doing, you're more aware of all the sort of processing your brain is doing to indicate to you, like, what should you do next. But the more experiences you have, and this is why I would advise people out there, trust the intuition of your elder coaches. You know, I think Paul referenced earlier, he was able to get some really helpful advice at a time when he was, you know, he's still a pretty young coach, but he was an even younger coach then. And, you know, the way that those older coaches are just able to drop intuition, it's because they have so much experience sort of viewing situations like the one that that they're faced with at that very moment. And so everything's gotten sort of short-wired in their brain that's saying, oh yeah, you do this. I guess for the younger of us, Nico, it's just something to look forward to, that the more experience you get, the better your intuition will get on the pool deck.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of like something, I guess the easy part in doing test sets or stuff like that is the measuring. If you're organized and you have everything that you may need, it's the easy part. And I guess the hard part is the intuition. And the harder part for some coaches, and I noticed that myself, is like, put your stopwatch away for once, you know? Because you're not going to listen to what your gut says if you're still going to look at your watch.
Right.
And it's a hard thing to do, you know? But you have nothing to lose putting your stopwatch away for one practice. If you don't like it, go get them again.
I wrote a blog about that once. Put your stopwatch away and watch. But of course, there are also situations where you might want to time. Paul, final thoughts. Final want to wrap a bow on this conversation.
Sure. Yeah, I think that the big thing for me with coaching is the fact that we've got different organisms that we're dealing with. And everybody can, you know, everybody it reacts differently to different stimulus. And it's our job to figure out, you know, how to get the most out of the athletes. And you know, so we've got a lot to balance and a lot to manage. And, you know, it's a job that takes a lot of communication and a lot of, you know, just kind of trial and error and measuring and recording. And the more you're doing that, I also think the more engaged. Do things again, you know, even if it's not a test set, maybe repeat sets as you do. And that makes coaching fun. It makes, I think the swimmers, you know, when they see those, you know, those improvements, you know, off of doing, whether it be a test set or a repeated set, I think it makes them, you know, excited. And through that, they have a lot more fun and they're going to end up going a lot faster.
Well, Paul, I'm excited to have you back up in the Northeast, and excited to see what's in the future for North Baltimore. And you've been really great today to join us for this conversation and explain a lot of just. I think this is really the exactly what Nico and I hoped for this podcast was. You know, to have a podcast that was not only about workouts, but a lot about the how and the why of workouts. And you've been very generous with that. So thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yep. And Nico, hope that things in Switzerland, you guys must have your outdoor nationals coming up. Yeah,
it's about two more weeks on summer nationals. It's not as exciting as it sounds, unfortunately, over here. But not having athletes, I may go there and just kind of do it in a different role for once, you know.
Yeah, I always like a good less prominent outdoor Swiss national meet. always fun for me. All right, guys. Thanks. And until next time.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks so much to Paul for coming on and giving us some really great insight into the why and how of how he coaches. Thank you also to Nico Messer from Pro Swim Workouts for bringing that European perspective to the pod. Thank you to everyone for listening. For more great swimming conversations, go to chrisdcoach.com. That's C-H-R-I-S, D as in DeSantis, coach.com. You can also find me at Chris DeSantis Coaching on Facebook. Write me a message. Give us some feedback. You can also make an account at Pro Swim Workouts. That's proswimworkouts.com and get access to their database of top-notch swimming practices. Remember to use the coupon code CRDeSantis when registering for a premium subscription. You get 20% off and you help support this podcast and Chris DeSantis Coaching. Thanks for listening and see you next week.